Hello and welcome to The X-Ray. I'm Fernando Espuelas in Washington. It's exhausting opening the New York Times or Wall Street Journal apps and reading the constant stream of news about our dysfunctional politics. The ceaseless fight between Democrats and Republicans has now been supplemented by the growing MAGA movement and its decidedly anti-democratic fervor. So many people ask, can we do any better? Why are we stuck with only two parties that seem to care more about their fight for power than actually solving the nation's problems? Enter Andrew Yang. You know him from his explosion onto the national stage in the 2020 election. This entrepreneur without government experience jumped into the arena of politics with a new message: universal basic income. Without getting too deep into this concept, let's just say that it's the radical idea of giving every adult a set amount of money every month, a means to alleviate poverty and also deal with the reality of an automated, AI-driven economy that simply does not need as many workers as before. This revolutionary program was met with some disdain at the time, but has now become a serious point of discussion as we envision a tech-transformed society. So can Yang see into the future? Not sure, but he certainly has big ideas that challenge our settled view of the world. In his latest conceptual leap, Yang is the co-founder of a new political party, the Forward Party. Can this new platform deliver us from the chronic dysfunction of the Republican-Democratic dynamic? But first, do you have a political question yearning for an answer? Write me and I'll respond on a future episode. Go to thexray.org to send me your question. And now, my conversation with Andrew Yang. Andrew Yang, welcome to The X-Ray.
Great to be here, Fernando. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. Let me just start out. I'm one of those centrists that the Forward Party is looking for. But I'm also one of those centrists who, I guess, I'm very scared of a third party. Scared because of the history of third parties in the American political system. I've read all your materials, so I know almost what you're going to say about this. But as you're now a couple of years into this project, how do you address that concern that a third party in this very inefficient duopoly that we have in the United States won't just be a spoiler, as has been sometimes the case?
Sure. You probably know what I'm going to say, Fernando, to your point. But I'm just going to illustrate. This past weekend, I was in California teaming up with a group called Common Sense that wants to introduce a new party to the state of California. And so you might think, oh, it's going to be a spoiler and mess things up. But then you reflect for a moment and say, wait a minute. California is a supermajority Democratic state, 2-1 Dems, 75% of state legislators are Dems. But if you go to San Francisco and LA, where I was, there are a lot of Democrats who are very frustrated with the homelessness or the public safety or the affordability issues or the schools or whatever the issue is. But if you are a Democrat in government in California, you don't have any meaningful competition because it's not like a Republican is going to show up and threaten you. So the voters get frustrated. The people in power just shrug and trade it amongst each other and play their inside baseball. And so Californians are fed up. So when I was there, I said, hey, guys, why not have a Common Sense party here in California? And then you can run against whomever you want. Your downside is that the Democrats in power would have to deliver better. Your upside is that maybe someone gets into office that actually doesn't owe anyone anything from the special interests and within the establishment. And so 1,000 Californians showed up and said, this sounds good to me. And let's sign up. So we are halfway to party recognition in California, which is a very significant state. The entire spoiler effect assumes essentially that you're talking about a presidential election and two parties. But you have 520,000 races around the country, including in San Francisco and LA, the vast majority of which don't have any meaningful competition. 75% of the country is blue or red and thus uncompetitive. So when we're in California, we're talking about fed up Democrats or independents or whomever, then you go to Missouri and it's just the reverse. It's like Missouri, the Republicans are there. They don't have anything to worry about from Democrats. So really we're being duped into thinking that we have a genuine choice. Like the vast majority of Americans listening to this, you don't have any choice in your representation. 90% of the districts are carved up to be either blue or red. And so we're here to say, look, that's driving bad results for everybody, and let's change it.
Yeah, I was 10 years in L.A. Covering politics, and you know, the number of corrupt Democrats there was just an embarrassment. And I think when you read about, you know, red states having corruption issues, it's the same kind of dynamic, right? It's not a competitive system, and therefore...
The worst number of parties you can have is one.
Yeah.
And functionally, three quarters of the country has one party.
Right. Right.
You know, and then if you show up and say, hey, let's do something about it, they'll be like, oh, no, no. And they'll try and distract you with, you know, frankly, the sliver of races in another part of the country that might be contested. By the way, this one party rule, it's bad for everyone. It's bad for results. It's bad for policy. But it's going to lead to some bizarro things. You know, so let's say I live in New York, which is a very blue area. And are Republicans getting stronger in New York? Yes, because the Democrats like aren't making people happy. And then people look up and shrug and being like, well, if I don't like these guys, I guess the only thing I can do is vote for a Republican. I mean, how the heck does a George Santos get into Congress? It's because the folks in Long Island showed up and were just like, don't like the Dems.
So, yeah.
You know what I mean? So like a healthy system is a win for everybody.
Now, of course, the only thing that the Democrats and Republicans agree, and I don't mean the people, but the party structures, is that there shall not be any successful third parties, right? I mean, they complement each other, especially, you know, in court cases and so forth. They support each other to make sure that you fail or parties like yours fails. So what is the mechanism that you're going to employ to be able to convince Americans that in fact, exactly what, by the way, I agree 100% what you're saying. I mean, being in LA, you just want to pull your hair out. It's just completely insane. What can you do? I mean, what's the process to persuade millions of voters that this is a path that's legitimate and effective?
This is the fun part. So if you want to start a party, what you're really talking about is talking 51 organizations, one in each state, and then a national umbrella. So we're grinding it out. We now have some level of ballot access or party recognition in half a dozen states. Going up all the time. We were targeting 20 by the end of this year. So I march around the country teaming up with the folks who want to create a new choice in their community. And when you ask, hey, how can we demonstrate it? I mean, we just have to do it the hard way, which is like, well let's just get a party set up in your state.
Right.
Anyone listening to this is like, oh, I kind of like the idea, but I don't know if it can be done. My suggestion is just go to forwardparty.com and there's a map and then just click on your state. Mm-hmm. And then you'll see a bunch of activists who are like, hey, this is how we get a new party in your state. And then what seems impossible then becomes very practical or logistical or tactical.
Right.
Like in California, you need 73,000 registrants. We have 32,000 so far. Does that seem impossible?
No, not even
heck
a little
bit. I mean, heck, right. You're like in you know, a giant state and everyone's fed up.
Right.
So when you start breaking it down, then it becomes 50 achievable tasks.
Mm-hmm.
And after you get that party set up in that state, does that allow you to run someone in every race? Like, no. But can you look around and say, well, look, there's a nonpartisan mayor's race. There's a nonpartisan school board race. I'm going to tell a story that really hits home why we need to do this. And we are laser focused on these local races. I was told about a school board race where there were four candidates. There was one far left, one far right, and then two kind of reasonable parents who just wanted to, you know, do good stuff. So the Democratic Party endorsed the far left. The Republican Party endorsed the far right. And then those two won, and now they just yell at each other and can't get anything done. And then the two...
Right. Typical.
Is this not a microcosm for the country? So like, if the Forward Party existed in that state, they would have gotten behind the two in the middle. And then if we get to a point where that's a signal to voters being like, oh, that's actually the person I want.
So you guys are also taking kind of a, I would say, a meta approach, right? Which is that when we look at the parties, in fact, the biggest party is not a party at all. It's independents, people who, you know, for whatever reason, don't want to identify with either party. But we also know from voting behavior, right, that the term independent is kind of not real in the sense that there is leaning to the Republicans, leaning to the Democrats, and mostly people don't switch back and forth. There's some switching, but very little. Is that your primary public that you're trying to impact and engage with? Or is there a broader group of people you think are persuadable?
You know, the truth of it, Fernando, is that if I sit with a mainstream Democrat they don't love the Democratic Party
right.
a lot of the time. I sit with the Republicans, certainly a lot of them are like totally uncomfortable with the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. There's this majority of Americans who don't think it's working. They can have any letter next to their name. Certainly being an independent is more and more commonplace because folks realize it's not working so well. I think it's something like 2/3 of young people don't like either party.
Right.
So take your pick, really, if you're us. I will say that the early adopters of Forward have taken on a particular thread or bent. I see a lot of people from military families or military veterans who are about country over party, and they feel like it's been the reverse for the parties. So, and that honors me and everyone involved with Forward that we're attracting so many military veterans. There are moderate Republicans who think the Republican Party's lost its mind. Don't disagree. So that's, you know, there are a lot of business types. And there are the card-carrying independents who've wanted some kind of alternative for a long time and get it deeply.
And now I find that an element of the Forward Party is both extremely attractive to me intellectually, but also challenging emotionally, which is that rightly you're saying ideology should not be the driver. It should be a problem-solving results, fix things for people, right? Which is intellectually a complete coherent point of view. But emotionally, people put on the colors, right? They want to, first of all, I mean, humans in general, right? We like our team, we hate the other team. How do you engage people when you move beyond ideology to now, quote unquote, results? Is that enough emotional meat to engage an electorate, you think?
What's funny, Fernando, is that I had this problem over and over again, where when I was running for president, people would be like, oh, you're way too cerebral. You're way too wonky. You're like, way too dirty.
Right.
You know, you got to appeal to the heart, emotions, the heartstrings. And, you know, for better or for worse, I approach things a certain way where it's like, it's a problem. Okay, there's a problem. How do we solve it? This is how we solve it. But the fun thing is that the Forward Party has attracted that tribe. And I joke sometimes it's like the tribe that doesn't like tribalism. You know what I mean? Like the tribe of the non-tribal, the tribe of the rational or the solutions-oriented or the logical. But the magic of what we're doing is that you do not need 51% of people to join your tribe. You need maybe 10%. And are there 5 to 10% of Americans who love the entire logic, solutions orientation, and the rest of it? Probably. And that's enough. Now, we're going to get together in our national summit in June. You're very much invited.
Okay, thank you.
And hammer out some things that might feel a little bit more visceral or emotional. But part of it is that we want that to be something that is bottom up and not top down. And it's born of the passionate activists and leaders who are doing the work in the states, as opposed to, you know, me and some folks in a room.
But what is the glue, right? Because problem solving is laudable and needed, but it's also a bit of a generic, right? I mean, every politician, mostly failing, but says, I'm here to solve your problems. Ultimately, when you look at political movements, they tend to gravitate around either a big idea or a set of ideas or a big character or a couple of characters, right? And you guys, I mean, there's you and there's Governor Whitman and Jolly and other people as well. I mean, how do you break through in the consciousness of people where voters say, aha, finally, I have that solution I didn't have before? I mean, what is that mechanism? And also should mention that you've made a point, the party has made a point, I should say, that you're not looking for $1 billion to compete with the other two parties, that you're taking a different approach. So what is that on a kind of tactical
level? Oh, we would take $1 billion. I mean, you know, we're not idiots. But I think what you're suggesting is like, we're saying, look, we're not taking moonshots at national races. Like we're trying to elect school board members and county executives and the rest of it.
Right.
And you can punch above your weight in those environments. And 70% of those races are uncontested and they have a big impact on people's lives. And the two parties aren't even bothering. Like, do you think the Democrats are showing up in rural Missouri being like, hey,
right,
I really care about this? No, they're just like, whatever, we've given up on you. It's one reason why the country is in such dire straits.
Right.
So I joke with folks, and people listening to this are probably democracy nerds. It's what I call people, democracy nerds. So if you're a democracy nerd, really, you should check out Forward Party because we're trying to solve the problem. But to your point, the average American doesn't think like that. You know how the average American thinks? is there a person I like running in a race I care about that feels important to me? Mm-hmm. And so if you don't have those things, then it's hard to activate the average non-democracy nerd. So what we have to do is we have to set up the infrastructure, get the ballot access, get the passionate grassroots volunteers, and then get behind that awesome school board candidate, that awesome mayoral candidate, that awesome, maybe at the high side, like congressional candidate. And one of the fun things is that we can get behind awesome candidates who have a D or an R next to their name if it's helpful. Like if there's some secretary of state who happens to be, you know, like we're allowed to do that. So to your point, these types of movements get animated by people, by personalities, by candidates. And right now we don't have either like a singular candidate that everyone's, which I see as a virtue to your point. It's a, you know, like one of the weaknesses of some of these efforts in the past has been, it's been like a boom or bust. The figure shows up and then disappears. We're the long-term builders.
I guess I'm still traumatized by 2000 and the 100,000 votes Nader got in Florida, which tipped the election to George W. Bush and everything that happened from there. So let me ask you about that, because going from the theoretical conceptual to the practical, obviously we're entering a new electoral cycle. So how does the Forward Party play in that election where really, by most expectations at this very early stage, it's going to be quite the close affair and it might be decided by a few thousand votes in three key states, whatever that scenario. What's your role there?
So in 2024, to me, the action is going to be around whether we can get some of these reforms across the finish line in places like Nevada, Arizona, maybe PA, maybe Minnesota, though that's legislative, which is itself very, very exciting, is that you have the clash of the moment. But then long term, like what's our way out of this? And long term, the way out of this is to realign the incentives of our legislators with the people. Right now, they're with 10 to 12% of the most extreme partisans on either side, because that's the only way you can lose your job is if you have your own party primary intern on you. But Maine, Alaska, and then in this last cycle, Nevada, all voted to turn off the party primaries. So Nevada has to do it again in 2024. That to me, other people, I mean, obviously I'll be very, very concerned about the presidential too. But if Nevada passes this ballot initiative in 24, then it's going to turn off the party primaries in a very important state and make it so that anyone can vote for anyone. And the winner is chosen via ranked choice voting. It's going to be transformative. It's just what Alaska did, which got Sarah Palin out and Mary Peltola in, and Lisa Murkowski survived voting to impeach Trump, et cetera. So in 2024, can we make that happen in Nevada? Can we make that happen in Arizona? A big picture, to your point, your vote's not going to matter. My vote's not going to matter. You know whose votes are going to matter? Michigan, Wisconsin, PA, Arizona, Nevada, Georgia, New Hampshire. So if we could get a critical mass of independent or swing voters in those states to say, look, we're independents, we're going to get behind whichever major party decides to get behind some of these reforms, you know, like that could be very positive and helpful. So that's the kind of project that I'll be engaged in.
Yeah, I mean, I think the ranked choice voting experience in Alaska is really so interesting, right? Because you have the Republican Senator Murkowski endorsing the Democratic candidate for the House and vice versa, and basically getting the extremes out of the election. At the same time, the critique of that model is that it's very hard to understand from a pure human level, right? I mean, there's the way that actually...
You just explained it, Fernando. What's hard to, what's hard to understand?
So you don't think that's a problem, right? I mean, that if you're able to get these reforms through, that people will embrace this kind of revolutionary and seemingly quite positive outcome that we saw in Alaska with moderation being the winner. You think this is a viable potential reform for multiple states?
It's the only way out of this mess, mm-hmm. Fernando, because mm-hmm. realistically, look up. You have a 22% congressional approval rating and a 94% incumbent reelection rating.
Yeah.
So, the incumbents are in there and they're just like, okay, how can I lose my job? Oh, if the crazies of my own party turn on me. So let me just placate and please them and act Looney Tunes.
Yeah.
So, if you fix that, you have a chance.
Yeah.
And you saw it in Alaska. If Alaska didn't have these reforms, Sarah Palin's a member of Congress. We're all 2 IQ points dumber. She's like, they're making, having fun with Marjorie Taylor Greene and the rest of it. And Lisa Murkowski is out, or Lisa Murkowski does not vote to impeach Trump
right.
because she had a party primary and was like, well, that's essentially a career ender. So by the way, a half a dozen senators have gone up to Lisa Murkowski on the Senate floor saying, I envy you so much that you don't have a primary.
Yeah.
So let's set these people free to do the right thing. And Nevada, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party both came out against this question three, which was like, hey, let's make it, of course.
Of course.
But here was the winning advertisement and argument. It was a military veteran looking to camera saying, I went overseas to defend the country. Hmm. I came home. I can't vote in our primary. I don't think that's right. And then the average Nevadan was like, well, that's not cool.
Yeah.
So, this is the hope. This is where the real action is reforming our system and not, look, I prefer good people to bad people. I prefer moral people to immoral people. But we have to get over the fact we can just eke out a win with like this good person this time. It's going to save the day. It's not. Like the only way to save the day is if we cure the system.
You're an entrepreneur. You're solving problems, right? I mean, that's your approach. Do you think, and I wanted to ask you more of a personal question, you ran for president, you then ran for mayor of New York, and you did quite well objectively in both races. You didn't win, but you did very, very well. What did you take away from those experiences that you're applying now?
So I came off the president. I did write a book about this, Fernando. I should send it to you.
Oops. Yes. I should have read that before I interviewed.
So because you're a democracy nerd, you would dig it.
Okay. I'm going to check it out. I'm going to buy it.
I'll send you a signed copy, man. Just DM me your address after this.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Learned a lot, to your point. And what's fun was like I tried to write the book quickly because I was like, what did I learn? What did I learn? Like, I wanted to capture it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So among the things I learned is that at this point, your relationship with media is actually a sign of partisanship, where 69% of Democrats have a high trust in media. Independents is 38%, and then Republicans is 15%. So how could Trump run roughshod on the Republican primary? He showed up and was like, yeah, you're all full of it. You're all full of it. And Republicans are like, yeah, yeah. And then on the other side, Democrats are like the last of the institutionalists. They're like, what am I supposed to do? Who am I supposed to vote for? So, and right now, Joe Biden's running for re-election. And, I said to Marianne Williamson, she was running, and I was like, Marianne, like, FYI, there's not going to be a Democratic debate. And she was like, what are you talking about? And I was like, well,
yeah.
I don't think that's the way they play. So there's like an asymmetry in the parties. I mean, they're having different issues. Mm-hmm. But the big thing I learned was that right now, the way that we're taught that things work is not how they actually work. The way we're taught things work is like, have a message, the media then will interpret that message and relay it to the public. You have policyholders that will then act on what people want and think. And actually, there's this institutional layer that's trying to prevent what I just said from happening at any moment in time. I can give you an example from the New York City mayoral just to give people a sense of it. I can use presidential too. What percentage of Iowans do you think participated in the Democratic caucus that me and Joe and everyone else were part of? Yeah, 6.5. And it was a similarly low percentage in the Democratic primary in New York City, where about 900,000 people voted, which is, by the way, it was up 10%. So it was like a good cycle. But this is a city of 9 million. So you had 10% vote, and then the winner might have gotten 3.6%. And by the way, you needed to have registered as a Democrat 4 months ahead of time in order to participate. So if you're an independent who was like, hey, I want to vote. By the way, I had this conversation hundreds of times. They were like, hey, can't wait to vote for you. And I'm like, great. Are you registered Democrat? And like, no. It's like, well, then you're out of luck. And so you have to ask yourself, it's like, wait, why would you make that the system where you make it almost intentionally difficult for people to vote? Why, if you're the Democratic Party, are you against an all-party primary in Nevada? It's because right now the system is contained. It's predictable. The consultants will tell you your win number and you know how to keep things under wraps. If you introduce genuine a lowercase d democracy, then it gets much more uncertain, and the institutions don't like uncertainty.
Absolutely. Well, last question.
Last question. This is so much fun, Fernando. Okay. We're just getting going.
I'm mindful of your time.
Thank you. That's kind.
But yeah, I don't want to abuse of your good nature and generosity of speaking with me today. But let me ask you, and I don't mean this as a gotcha question at all, but is the eventual plan of the Forward Party for you to be the presidential candidate?
That is certainly not the plan. You can talk to just about anyone who's there being like, I haven't heard a seen a whit of that. I mean, we're grinding it out, just trying to make things happen in these places. I mean, being very frank.
All right. Well, Andrew Yang, thank you so much for joining the X-Ray today. I really appreciate it. Interesting conversation, and I wish you well. It's a very interesting approach, and definitely the country needs it.
How did my X-Ray come out? Is the prognosis positive?
Your X-Ray is fantastic. I have to say, very positive, and we'll follow up with you when we get the rest of the test results.
I'll take it. I'll take it, Doc.
All right, Andrew, thank you so much. Thank you, sir. You might disagree with Andrew Yang's ideas, but his fresh-eyed view of politics is definitely provocative. Whether the Forward Party, however, becomes a catalyst for a more robust democracy remains to be seen. But what is clear to me, at least, is that Andrew Yang will continue to be a dynamic force in our political system. I want to thank Andrew for his insights today, and I also want to thank the production team, Nicole Legacy, Sydney Richards, and Renee Pineda. And I want to thank you for joining me on this episode of The X-Ray. I'm Fernando Espuelas. For more information on this podcast, check out thexray.org and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform.
The X-Ray with Fernando Espuelas is an editorially independent production of Issue 1.